approaching a new area with cliffs, particularly such as this one, you could be getting a downdraft or an updraft. Now, an updraft doesn't matter because it's going to take you up, but a downdraft is dangerous. And you feel your way into the area almost like a glider pilot feels the thermal. You only fly the helicopter as the helicopter's designed to fly, and then the cameraman comes second as far as I'm concerned. Now, in the first run at low level, when the climbers are low on the cliff, it would be dangerous to remain in a hover. Therefore, I'll keep the helicopter moving, say, 5 to 10 knots. I fly as you wish, within safety. I can't do the impossible with the machine because it's endangering people's lives, both on the ground and in the helicopter.
How's it going, Mark?
Not bad.
Yeah. We've been listening or watching a video that was taken in the mid-70s.
Yep.
Of our dad. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good video. Good to have.
To be able to have it. Like, it's a snippet. Just a snippet of him. But it's all we've got.
Mm.
And I think that's why, you know, podcasts are so good, because we can have a snippet of someone and share it. But that particular story, you were there. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was. Got the afternoon off school and went down, overnighted, and got to fly around. It was good.
How old were you?
Year, grade three. So I would have been about 8, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That would have been, all your schoolmates would have been.
Yeah, they were pretty jealous.
Hmm.
Although most of them don't believe you, so it's been the story of my life. I normally don't tell people anything about my what I do or any of that, because it's too far fetched.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, so.
Well, while they were filming that rock climbing video, what were you doing?
At times I was on the ground, and at other times I was in the machine with them.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the first time I was in the machine, the cameraman got in, and the harness in those days was pretty agricultural, and the lead on it was actually a large motorcycle chain wrapped in plastic. And so I'm sitting down, and the guy gets in, the camo gets in, and attaches the lead to the seat across my belly.
Oh.
And Dad turns around and goes, no, don't do that. In case you fall out, you'll cut him in half.
Yeah.
So he tucked it behind me. But it was a big, big heavy motorbike type chain.
Right.
Yeah, for locking your bike up.
Not like the harnesses they've got nowadays.
No, it wasn't at all.
That would have been a pretty amazing day for an 8-year-old.
Mm. Mm. But still, for them to have harnesses back then, it was, because it wasn't, I don't think it was a legal requirement back then. It was just a safety device that they used. So, you know, he could have done what he did sitting in the seat with the seatbelt on, which is what you can do today.
Mm. Yeah, totally. As long as you don't hang outside.
Yeah, don't undo your seatbelt.
Mm.
You should be right.
Yeah. So, is that where you got your aviation bug?
I think I got it a little bit before then, when we went on a family day outing to Rye in a helicopter.
Oh yeah, okay.
I think that was the one that got me. That was a couple of years earlier.
Mm, I remember that day.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that, like the first rotation from the helipad, I thought, right, I'm going to do this.
Did you?
Yeah. I don't know how, but this is it. This is it for me.
Mm.
Mm. So yeah, any time there was a chance to go down the airport, I was down there.
Yeah, well, you could probably put money on, as a young kid, expecting that they were going to follow in their father's footsteps.
Well, if you're doing something exciting like that, you know, we were the only kids at school that had a father as a helicopter pilot.
Mm.
That's why you never got believed.
Yeah, that's true. No one did believe it, did they?
No. So you're better off. Often not telling them.
Mm, tell them you're a dolphin trainer.
Yeah, something like that.
Mm. But you you went on initially to become an engineer.
Yeah, well, I couldn't afford to do the training. I was not that long out of school, only a couple of years. I'd been working as an apprentice fitter and turner, and got a bit frustrated with that, so I changed to motor mechanics. But I hadn't saved any money. And you and Chris raced off to do your training, and I was desperate to get going with you in some way, shape or form. So the easiest thing for me to do was to try and get in through the hangar door. And that's what I did. Just kept knocking on the doors and eventually got a start. Got a job at J-Ro for a month, sweeping the floor, and stayed there for 9 years.
Yeah, well, that would have been a good place to learn.
Yeah, it was a good training ground, and you know, there wasn't very many helicopters in Australia in those times, so they had a lion's share and a large chunk of work. So they were busy all year round.
And what sort of work were you doing, like, as an engineer with them?
It was all varied. It was mostly utility work, a little bit of joyriding in between there. You know, I went to Cairns for 5 years, and it was scenic flights and tourism up there. But in the background, while Cairns was always going on, was mineral exploration and mining support and filming and slinging and all of those sorts of things.
Everything.
That required engineering support in the background, you know, to install cameras, to rig slinging gear, to do all that sort of stuff. So there was a lot of out of hangar time, which was good. I enjoyed it. You know, it got me closer to the coalface and seeing how the helicopters operate. You know, when you're away, when the helicopter leaves the hangar and the engineer's left behind, he doesn't know what it gets up to. With J-Ro, it was consistent year after year, and then after I left them, various other companies would have you doing field excursions, but not in the bush like we were, 5 weeks on, 1 week off. Five on, one off, five on, one off.
So you were able to just get into the groove of it.
Yeah, that's what I think was happening back then, when all these other people were avoiding those tasks. I'd be happy to take them on.
You'd relish it.
Yeah, in some regards, yeah. I certainly, you know, when I started working with a group of engineers, because often, you know, machines are small, you only need one or two guys. It's only if you're doing a big refurb or something that you get a team of guys. So you're often working by yourself or just with one or two others. But when I started working at Youngers with a team of engineers, I'd be happy to stand back and take the worst job that nobody wanted, because I would prefer to do that than to listen to them whinging about it. So yeah, it didn't, you know, there was no job that I didn't enjoy doing if it involved servicing or maintaining a helicopter. It was just part of the job. You know, there was no good jobs or bad jobs.
Yeah.
There was certainly easy jobs and difficult jobs, but it was all good.
Do you think that Dad's accident changed the way you looked at engineering?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because, and you can see that in the guys I work with. They just don't look at things in the same manner. You know, the little is trivial, whereas the little can be crucial. So, you know.
So in some ways it affected you, like his accident affected you in a positive way from the point of view of being an engineer, but also, you know, it would, in a negative way, because you were different to the other engineers.
I mean, as an engineer, in your mind's eye, you can see all those gears and bearings whirring around a million mile an hour, and you know any one of them could go bang at any minute. You know, like when I see guys who have the confidence to long line construction, like build an oil rig or a drill rig on a long line, they're sitting there happily in 100-foot hover. Hats off to them, because I'm very nervous in that.
Yeah.
In that environment.
From what you know about.
From what I know about mechanics, that's not an environment I want to spend a lot of time in. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I agree.
Hats off to them that they do it with the confidence they do it with.
Or maybe they just don't think about it.
Maybe. Well, a lot of pilots aren't very engineering savvy, and you know, there's no real requirement for them to be. So long as they do a thorough pre-flight and they know it. Basically what they're looking at, they don't have to have a thorough understanding. It's helpful, but it's not required.
From an engineering point of view, have you got any thoughts or opinions on Dad's accident?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I chased that up quite a lengthy way, really, after Chris died, and went to the National Archives and read old letters and all sorts of things and read the Bassey Report. And I think what their theory was is a pretty good one, that perhaps this box of Dade's caught fire on the side of the aircraft and snuffed the engine out. The lie of the land, the accident scene, lends it to that kind of scenario. Whereas what one other, I mean, I had the opportunity to interview everyone he worked with over that 9 year period. I had an opportunity to learn what was going on in the company back then, and things weren't good in the company back then, so yeah, I think that it's highly likely that box caught fire and put the engine out. The thing with that particular accident was there was no facility for the pilot to jettison the box. Only the guy operating it could. And if this box went up in his face, he might have been incapacitated with smoke and unable to jettison it. And that's why they found Dad with his left hand on the cyclic. Whereas if he had a hand-controlled release, and they put the hook release on the 500 on the cyclic, they could have used that, and he might not have needed to change hands, and they might have been able to get rid of the box sooner.
So the box was, they were doing forestry burn-offs.
Yeah, with a delayed action incendiary device, like a big match, and the box was attached to the outside of the front co-pilot's door that had been cut down. So in all of that wind up and wash up, the only thing that I couldn't discover was an approval for that modification. Nowhere in the paperwork was there any approval for a modification like that.
And in many ways, that's highlighted a shortfall in the industry. But nowadays, you pretty much couldn't get airborne with an unmodified
Yeah.
or an unapproved modification.
That's correct, yeah.
Interesting that you were able to chat to all of the, you're working in the same company, you're able to chat to all the co-workers and.
Yeah, well, only one guy gave me the theory that it was late in the afternoon and they flew into a tree because they couldn't see it.
But normally they wouldn't be that low
I can't
for
imagine it. I mean,
incendiary dropping.
it was an unusually large tree. It did stick out above the other trees on that spur. But like you said, I don't think they would need to be that low. There'd be no need for it. And the tree wasn't three times the size, it was just a bit bigger. It stuck out.
Yeah. And if we go back to the video that we were looking at of the rock climbing video, he talks about how he's going to operate safely and not outside the limits and be mindful of the aircraft limitations and also the height above the ground and your speed. And so it wasn't like he was a reckless kind of pilot.
No, I don't think there's any suggestion of that.
What about your, you mentioned Chris, what about your engineering perspective on that?
Well, didn't appear to be a normal accident. Something forced them to the ground, that, and whatever that something was, caused the aircraft to be unable to be properly operated. So, for them to be unable to successfully, even an unsuccessful auto-rotation wouldn't look like that. That was a hard and fast hit, and it's not what helicopters generally do. We're low and slow. That aircraft did hit the ground hard, and something had failed that caused that to happen. But because of the state of the wreckage and the fire, it was impossible to determine.
Have you racked your brain over that?
Yeah, plenty of times. Yeah, yeah.
No answers.
Well, I mean, all those blades were missing off the fan. It's not to say that one blade didn't take the collective lever out. But then that has happened in the past, and it's put the rotor system into full course, not full fine. So, because I do concur with the ATSB report that the engine wasn't running when it hit the ground. That was determined, you could tell by the way the flywheel had deflected. It wasn't spinning. at the time that it bent, it was stopped. So, yeah, some disastrous mechanical occurrence caused that aircraft to slam into the ground. It wasn't pilot error.
Can you elaborate on the controls of a helicopter, like from a pilot engineer perspective?
And what are all the controls?
Yeah, just how they work together, and in particular the relationship between the cooling fan and the collective, and how that could affect the collective.
Well, every helicopter has a different way of making the connection between the pilot's grip and the road ahead. Sometimes they use cables, sometimes they use rods, sometimes they use a mixture of things, bell cranks and levers, and but in most helicopters, it's a direct connection by some way. And in this particular model, and there had been instances in the past where mounted on the front of the engines, so just behind where the backseat passengers would sit, there's a cooling fan running off belts like car fan belts. And beneath that is the flight controls from the pilot before they start heading upwards. They're heading longitudinally like a three or four broomsticks lying in the bottom of the aircraft, and they run directly beneath the fan. Now when we found the fan, there are several blades missing, but the ATSB in their wisdom determined that they came detached post-impact. But it has happened in the past where the fan blade is let go and it's sliced through the flight control, the broomstick under there. And in one instance, I think it was with Ron Newman out the front of JRO, it went full course, and he was able to wind the throttle back and get it on the pad.
What do you mean full course?
It took the collective lever out and it went full collective up.
Which means the helicopter's going to want to climb.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the only way to solve that is to shut the engine down.
Well, I don't know about that, because if you shut your engine down, then you committed, aren't you?
Mm.
You committed only, and if you can't go into autorotative pitch, then shutting your engine down wouldn't help. You're better off to maintain, if you can, if the engine will provide the power, because it might not. At full course, the engine just might bog down and over pitch.
Mm.
But the fact that the fan wasn't spinning on contact, and also the flywheel wasn't spinning on contact with the ground in the initial impact, you know, they've had something majorly go wrong where, A, the engine's off for some reason, whether they shut it off, you know, if the fan did let go, it would have been noisy, and after it letting go its blades, it would have vibrated. I don't know if the vibration would be enough to want to shut it down, whether you just keep running with your engine vibrating. But if that's what's happened, you know, if the fans let go and they've made the decision to shut the engine down and part of their flight control's taken out, I'd hate to, yeah, it just doesn't bear thinking about, like, honestly. It's the worst of the worst scenarios.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, uncontrollable. Yeah. Was the main rotor spinning at its correct RPM when it hit the ground?
Well, all the instruments and everything were destroyed, so but it certainly waffled a long way from the point of impact. Like, you know, most helicopters, you find the blades wrapped around them.
Mm.
Whereas these had wandered certainly a few rotor diameters off into the distance.
Like a child's top?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
Well, it's hard to imagine. They could have gone end over end. But, yeah, probably spinning like a top.
Mm.
So that shows some inertia,
yeah.
Because they surely would have hit the ground, you know, given the size of the crater that thing made for a small helicopter. You'd think the blades would have drooped down, hit the ground, and impact.
Mm, but the blades were largely intact.
Yeah, they're pretty warped and twisted, but yeah.
Mm.
I think there was, you know, undiscovered issues with both of them, and it was disappointing for the ATSB to put a, you know, kibosh on our inquiries and to call it fuel exhaustion, because
so quickly,
yeah, they just wanted to close the book on that.
Well, they admitted that they weren't interested in it except for the fact the beacon didn't go off.
Yeah, so that might have been different if it was a 44. There was more of them around.
Mm.
But because it was an old machine that there wasn't very many of, they decided not to pursue it. And, you know, we're going to wear that.
Mm. Just have to live with that unknown.
Mm.
Yep. Or in the world where everyone wants answers,
yeah,
we can't have any.
Yeah. Well, the answer is that those two boys won't be doing that again.
Hmm.
Hmm.
You said to me once that you became a better engineer the day you became a pilot.
Yep.
What did you mean by that?
Again, it's the small things, you know. You could have a thing like, you could have a simple thing like the pilot's eye window rattles as they go through translational lift. To an engineer, he's not interested in that. Close the window or open the window. Work around it. I couldn't be bothered. I haven't got time. But when an engineer becomes a pilot and he knows that, particularly at night, you're going through translational lift into a dark helipad and your window all of a sudden starts to make a racket and vibrate like it's going to fall out of its rails, that's a major distraction.
Mm.
And unfortunately, engineers don't see that perspective. They don't.
Well, they couldn't possibly.
No.
Mm.
So that's what I meant by that. I meant that next time a pilot comes to me with an issue, I'm taking a rag to that because the pilot has come to me.
Mm.
You know, it's not something he doesn't care about.
Mm.
It's something he does care about. And he wants it fixed. And if I can fix it, I'll fix it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Yeah. It should be a prerequisite that you do some sort of flying.
Well, they'd lose a lot of pilots. They'd lose a lot of engineers.
Yeah, they'd all become pilots.
Well, they would. They'd see how easy it is and they'd just want to do it.
Because you don't have to stand in a hangar for 10 hours a day.
That's right.
Mm.
Yeah.
You get to sit on a lounge and wait till someone calls you.
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, and, you know, sure, there are times when flying a helicopter is every bit as difficult as anything you can possibly do. It's still not hard
in
the scheme of things. You're not on a shovel.
Mm.
You know, you're not ramming pegs into a railway line with a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
You know, you've got everything at your fingertips that works, and it's only in your mind where the difficulty lies.
Mm.
The physical job isn't hard at all.
Mm.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It's plush and it's powered.
It might even be air conditioned.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you got any recollection of, like, some of your better jobs that you did that you enjoyed the most?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed all the flying that I did. There was, you know, if you end up building something with a helicopter, that's exciting and enjoyable. You can sort of sit back, or as you fly off, you can say, oh, we constructed that shed on that hill and we put that tower up. So those kinds of jobs are good. But I reckon the most satisfying is when you take someone for a joyride for the first time.
Oh yeah.
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 And particularly if they're apprehensive and nervous.
Mm.
And, you know, you can take that away from them and alleviate that fear that they've always had.
Mm.
And go away with a grin on their dial. So
yeah. Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, they cut their teeth on joyrides and never want to do them again, but I'd be happy to do that.
Mm.
No problem.
Mm. Yeah, just to see the smile.
Yeah.
And that first, you've talked about it a couple of times now, where that first bit where the nose rotates and...
Yeah, you start, away you go.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why everyone gets into it.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, you find yourself sitting in a big helicopter flying to an oil rig and you're not doing that sort of fun stuff anymore.
Nah, it's too regimented.
Mm. Yeah, almost airline-like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's the airline equivalent, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So... You're not flying anymore?
No.
Why is that?
I'm medically grounded.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the trifecta.
Go on.
I have PTSD, bipolar, and schizophrenia.
Yeah, right. That's a fucking pea soup of shit.
And the FAA medical don't like any of that on your medical certificate. So, as a result of that, I'll never fly again.
Mm. Yeah, that's a sad situation.
Oh, well, it's the situation I've got.
Mm.
I've had a few years to come to terms with it.
Mm. How long's it been?
10 years.
10 years since you've flown.
Professionally, yeah.
Mm. What happened? What was the cause of this?
I was tasked to fly an unserviceable helicopter by my chief pilot, and I refused. He insisted, so I grounded the aircraft. We had a verbal altercation, and I spoke to him in a way that, using language I knew he would understand, and he didn't like that, and so he attacked me with his fists and beat me up, and that happened at work. And since that day, I developed severe PTSD.
Mm.
Mm. And it has just progressed into bipolar and schizophrenia.
Mm. What did you say to him?
I called him a fairly dangerous Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he didn't like that?
No, he didn't like that.
Mm.
At all. But I picked him like a nose, because as soon as I said it, he demonstrated that he was actually fairly dangerous.
Mm.
Yeah. And then after the event, he still expected me to fly it.
Mm.
After they remedied the defect.
After he'd beaten you?
Yeah. Yeah. Normally on a footy field, you get 2 weeks off for a concussion.
Mm.
But not in the workplace, it seems.
Mm. So that was you out of work from that point in time, while you had to think about the situation, or were you able to get other flying jobs, or
that
obviously you didn't keep working there?
No, I didn't keep working there. I left on the day. I'd made my mind up that I wouldn't work for him again. And I did find other work for a private operator in Adelaide, just as a corporate pilot, but we didn't do any charter. And then, you know, my symptoms of PTSD and the onset of bipolar caused me to have a relapse and end up in hospital. And again, that's another big black mark against your name in the CASA medical.
Mm.
So yeah, once you've been tarred with that brush, you're pretty snookered.
Mm.
You're not going to untar yourself.
Yeah.
Mm.
Was the CASA supportive or sympathetic of your situation?
No, they didn't seem very interested in it at all. No.
They didn't care. They were happy with the person to remain in the industry that beats his staff, but they weren't happy to support the staff.
Well, they wouldn't even interview me about my complaint.
Mm.
So that was a bit disappointing
from
their perspective, given that they tout the fact that they are the safety authority.
Mm.
And I had a serious safety issue that they wouldn't address.
Mm.
So
you challenged him on a maintenance issue, which you obviously were an authority on.
Yeah, but I didn't need to be an authority. Like, yes, I am an authority because I'm a licensed engineer, but the pilot has the same authority. When that red light comes on the dashboard, the flight manual says further flight prohibited.
Mm.
That's it. You don't need to be an authority.
Mm.
And the only way to turn the light off is to clean the filters. It's the only way.
Mm.
It doesn't have a switch on it that you reset.
Yeah.
It's not a button that you press, not a toggle. The only way is to clean the filters and to remove that differential pressure, which is what the switch measures.
Mm.
Pressure from one side of the inlet filter to the other. And once that reaches a predetermined level, the light comes on.
What's the consequence of a blocked filter in this case?
The flight manual says that a blocked filter could cause compressor stall or surge. And in any aircraft, let alone a single engine helicopter, that's a critical situation.
Mm.
Critical.
Mm.
And compressor stall will result in a definite performance loss.
Mm.
And these things are performance limited anyway. You're flying around heavy all the time with no performance to spare.
Mm.
if you encounter a performance loss during takeoff or landing, you're probably going to hit the ground very hard.
Mm.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah. Do you think that you poked the bear?
Oh, for sure.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah, but in hindsight, somebody had to, because things were just out of control there. All their pilots had resigned except one.
Mm.
They'd all quit as a result of his behaviour.
Yeah. And yet that company still goes and prospers.
Yep. Yep.
Mm.
Yeah, they go through pilots and ground people and they just keep employing.
Did you have any support from like WorkSafe or anything like that?
A little bit, but they were keen to push a piece of legislation regarding bullying. And I said to them at the outset, I said, this goes well beyond bullying. I said, I'm not interested in the bullying application. And, you know, I got bashed up.
Mm.
And they kept pushing the bullying complaint and in the end couldn't find sufficient evidence to suggest bullying took place and closed the case.
Mm. So beating isn't bullying?
No.
It's not classed as?
No.
Bullying is a psychological warfare.
What beating is, there's another piece of their legislation, what bullying is, beating is intentionally harming a worker. And you can't do that.
Mm.
If I was to change your roster so you couldn't go to your daughter's netball lesson next Thursday, that's intentionally harming, or can be construed as.
Mm.
So if getting punched in the head several times isn't intentionally harming, what is?
Mm. Exactly.
So, intentional harm and failed to provide a safe workplace is what happened to me.
Mm.
And the failed to provide a safe workplace happened twice on that day. The first time, when I got tasked to fly an unserviceable aircraft and identified it and grounded, that was the first time. Then to be assaulted and given a concussion and then expected to fly that aircraft once the defect was rectified, that was the second time.
Mm.
An unsafe workplace was provided.
Mm.
In hindsight, I should have cranked up and flown myself direct to the RA and fallen out of the aircraft on the helipad.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm the patient. Come and get me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I knew that I couldn't fly anywhere after just having my brains bashed in.
Yeah, well, I've seen the vision and it's violent.
So there was no way I was getting in a helicopter.
Well, you would have been rattled for sure.
Oh, for sure.
Mm. So then, but basically from that day forward, it's been a slippery slope for you.
Yeah.
And not a happy one.
No.
No. It's like almost impossible to understand unless you've had a mental illness. It's impossible to understand a mental illness.
Mm.
Like, yeah. I can understand a broken leg.
Yeah. I would have been the first saying, harden up, princess, get back on your bike, you know, you'll be right, toughen up, here's a box of tissues.
Mm.
The first,
if
it happened to you.
Mm. Yeah, and why can't you do that?
Yeah, that's the funny thing with PTSD. You know, it doesn't leave you.
Mm.
Or if for those lucky enough that it does, it's almost for them like a miracle.
Mm. Yeah. So it's like nagging the whole time.
Yeah, but it fans out to all sorts of different... like there's the constant memory. And then there's
the constant memory of the event.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the way in which it was dealt with by the authorities.
So
I see a police car and I have a flashback.
Mm.
Like that kind of thing. I'll just say, oh, yeah, there's a copper. He didn't do his job. Bang. Back to where I started.
Mm.
But then the flashbacks, you know, I could have, depends on the day, I might not have any that I recall, but then I might have 20 or 30 flashbacks in a day.
Mm.
But they could be flashback to any aspect of my life.
Mm.
I could flashback to 4 years old, falling off my scooter and grazing my knee. Bang, flashback.
Mm.
And it takes your breath away.
Mm.
Takes your breath away. So, you know, when people who don't suffer from PTSD and they learn about people having flashbacks, it's not always the flashback of the event. It's just flashbacks of any and all events.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, the flashback is an incredible, it seems so accurate and so real, like it's yesterday.
How clever is the brain?
Yeah, I don't know where it gets it, and I don't know, there's no real trigger for it.
Well, you know, in my mind, when I try to rationalise it, I think if there's a switch that can switch PTSD on,
yeah,
there's got to be a way that you can switch it off.
You'd like to think.
Mm. But obviously that's not the case.
Well, I haven't found it yet.
Mm.
Yeah, so the only real tool that they've got is to numb the senses with medication.
Mm.
That's all they do for you.
Mm.
Just numb you up.
Yeah, which is no way to be.
No, not really. You don't achieve much in that heavily medicated state, and ask anyone.
So the medical system really has failed people with mental health issues.
I think that's a fairly true case, yeah. You know, there's lots of people in the mental health wards that shouldn't be there. And there's people in there that could be out in a couple of days if you just gave them the right person to talk to.
Mm.
But there's no facility for that either. There's no, once you go into a mental health ward, there's no therapy.
Mm.
There's no one to talk to.
Well, if you were an alcoholic, you could go to a rehab centre or those sorts of things and find some sort of, recovery technique. But as a mental health patient...
Well, there's no sitting in circles and telling your tale. There's none of that.
No?
No. No. No.
No one wants to hear it?
No.
Well, here we are today, so...
No, it's take your medicine and behave.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
On Thursdays, they might have a painting class. You know, on Tuesdays, they might do a cooking class. But that's about it.
Couldn't you be bothered, though?
No, because you're so heavily medicated.
Mm.
They wake you up. As soon as they know you're up, they start plying you with it.
Mm. Obviously, this whole situation has taken a toll on your family.
Mm. Very much.
Mm. And once again, it probably stems back to family members, and I'm one of them that can't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's probably more difficult for you guys than it is for me to understand.
Mm.
Because, as I said, I would be the first saying, harden up, princess, and I didn't even know this existed.
Mm.
You know, I thought when they were calling it shell shock, that was... actually what it was. You know, someone standing behind a big cannon going, banging the cannon off 50 times a day and he's shell-shocked.
Mm.
That's what I thought shell-shock was, but so ignorant was I.
Mm.
So that's just a term they used in the Second World War, but you could never man a big gun and be shell-shocked.
Mm. Have you figured out how it is that one person in a certain scenario can be so affected and the person next to him isn't?
No, it's... that's the mystery of it, really, because some people aren't. And look, I've had similar encounters in my life with near-death experiences and things like that, and I never had a reaction like this to any of those, motorbikes, helicopters.
Mm. What was your near-death experience?
Oh, I've nearly crashed. Not nearly crashed. I've crashed plenty of motorbikes. You've got 5 litres of blood. I lost 3 in one accident, and I was still on my feet. So, you know, but there's no shell shock from that accident. There's no PTSD from that.
But do you think that those sort of things, let's say, go right back, say, possibly your dad's accident, Chris's, your motorbike accident, they're cumulative to a final point where it just goes click?
Maybe. Could be. Mm. Yeah. Could be.
Yeah, I'm not an expert, so I wouldn't have a clue.
Don't know that it matters whether you've got accumulative stress and near-death experiences in your life. I don't know that that would make you more susceptible or not.
Mm. Well, definitely losing almost all your blood could be one of them.
Yeah, but see, I didn't know I'd lost nearly all of it because it wasn't on the floor. It was in my peritoneum. So there was no bleeding.
What did you do?
Stuck a handlebar in my guts.
During the crash?
Yeah.
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 Like apple cored yourself?
Nearly, yeah, but didn't break the skin. I just grazed it. The injury was internal.
So is that your aorta? That
Yeah, I ruptured my aorta, yeah. Usually you die at the scene.
Must have been like a tiny pinch.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does this develop into bipolar, and what is bipolar?
Bipolar, well, I don't know how it develops into it. I think it's just an accumulation of stress. That's what it's been explained to me. If you have PTSD and then you're under stress for a significant period of time, and in my case years, then it's not uncommon for bipolar to develop. And there's two kinds, there's bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. I have bipolar 1. Bipolar 2 is where your moods will swing rapidly during the course of the day. You might be up and down 4 or 5 times.
Okay.
Right? Rapid. And that's manic depressive. Whereas bipolar 1, you just gradually go high and you stay there.
Right, okay.
You stay high.
Yeah.
And they don't like you high on your own supply, so they got to get you down, and the only way that they know how to do that is put you in hospital and medicate you. They're not interested in your story. They're not interested in developing any kind of rapport with you. They're not interested in seeing whether or not you fit into a certain therapeutic regime, other than you will take these tablets, and if you don't take them, we'll get the guards to come in, we'll hold you down, we'll inject you with them. That's your only option.
Yeah, right. And that's happened to you?
Yeah, that happens both times. Most times, the guards will grab you and they'll just jab a needle in you.
You were saying that they, when you're in those facilities, they don't let you sleep.
Yeah, they don't. What they do is every hour on the hour, every night, night after night, they come around, they open your door, and they shine a torch in your eyes to see whether or not you're asleep. And, of course, that wakes you up. So, and they do it under the guise of safety. They think that what they're doing is checking up on you as their duty of care to ensure that in the night time you're not hatching a plan to hurt yourself.
Really?
Yeah. So every hour on the hour, you'll hear him coming down the corridor, you'll hear the keys in the door, you hear the door open to the guy next door, he'll get his torture, then you'll hear yours open, you'll get your torture. They go down the hall, round, come up the hall the other side. So this whole rigmarole takes probably 30 or 40 minutes with people walking around in the dead of night, rattling keys and opening and closing doors, shining people in your eyes. And by the time you've thought about even trying to get to sleep, it's your turn for another bit of torture. And it just doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. And it doesn't stop whether you're in South Australia or New South Wales. It's the same. They do it in the same place. And what I've found is easiest for me, you know, I'll talk to them about it and I'll tell them I'm not happy about it, but I'll just leave the door open. And that way they don't have to fiddle with my door and get the key out or anything like that. But they still come and shine a torch in your face. I don't need to. And in this modern day, we could have sensors in the mattress that take your heartbeat and your pulse. It can measure your temperature and all sorts of things, and they can do it from the computer. And they can monitor you the whole time you're in bed.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if she's come around for the fifth time that night and I'm ready to top myself, I know that as soon as she shuts the door, I've got an hour. To do the job.
Yeah.
It's only going to take 3 minutes and I'll be dead. So what are you doing and why are you doing it? So no one in there is happy about it. No patients are happy about it.
It seems like it is torture.
It is torture. It is, the definition of torture is exactly what they do. It is torture.
But even a layperson knows that sleep is vital for recovery.
Yep. And as soon as you get up in the morning after being tortured all night, the first thing they give you is a sleeping tablet. First tablet.
Really?
Yep. So, as soon as they know you are.
Mm.
Yep. Before you do breakfast. Right, here you go, Mark. Here's your morning pills. So.
And do they watch and make sure you swallow them? Or
yeah.
Could you,
oh, yeah.
You can't hide them and spit them out?
Not unless you're a pro at it. But no, they stand there until you hoof them down.
Mm.
Yep. Thank you, miss.
It's
thank
like
you,
one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Just
stuff.
Like it, yeah. But instead of using scalpels, they use chemical lobotomy.
Mm.
Yeah. Some people are getting a handful of tablets twice a day, like a handful.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's the medical fraternity in South Australia doesn't help mental health patients. All it does is get them off the street for 3 weeks and then puts them back out. It doesn't help them at all.
Yeah. And it's a big beast to try and change.
Oh, well, I don't think you could change it. Who's going to listen to a bunch of mental health patients? Mm. They're the only ones who are going to fight for this thing.
And there's a few of them out there.
Yep.
But you're not alone.
Oh, no. No, the place is normally full.
Mm.
But then it doesn't hold that many people in the scheme of things. It's probably got 30, 35 beds.
Mm. And that's why they're in a hurry to medicate you so as you can tick a few boxes and leave.
That's right.
So they can, because someone's waiting to come in.
Mm.
Mm. Tell us about the high that you were talking about.
Yeah, well, you find that you don't need as much food, that you don't sleep in. You know, you get up early. You're full of vitality. You have racing thoughts of all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas. Mostly about, well, for me anyway, going into business or making money. Or investing in something. So most of the ideas are like that. But there's also a sense of grandiosity and self-importance and that sort of thing that goes with it. And that's the traits that your family and your friends see, that Mark's not quite himself, you know.
Mm.
And that's when they start to get worried.
Mm.
When those sort of traits show themselves.
And sadly, the families would rather see you subdued.
Well, they don't know what to do, you see.
Mm.
And that's their only choice. There aren't choices.
Mm.
There's only one choice.
Mm.
Ring this number.
Yeah.
That's it.
Mm. But the high sounds like a good place to be.
It is, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. You sleep well. Everything you do is well. You care for what you eat. You're selective. Ablutions are clean and, you know, without any problems, whereas, you know, you get on a regime of medication and that just upsets your gastrointestinal tract no end, and you've got hurried bladder and hurried bowel, and, you know, it's a shambles sometimes.
Mm.
Because of the side effects of the medication.
Mm.
So, you know, when you're high and you're not medicated, you live what you believe to be a very clean existence.
Mm.
Yeah.
Imagine if there was a place where you could just be let loose.
Well, that would be the ideal thing. Mm. You know, if they would just let you loose. And I think I found a place similar to that, but it's not legitimate. But the place called the Arts Factory at Byron Bay is full of crazy people.
Mm.
It's full of them.
Mm.
You know, certifiably mental.
Mm.
And yet they're out and about living their lives. No one's dobbed them in yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I certainly found kindred spirit in Byron Bay.
Mm. Yeah, well, you seemed at your happiest.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of nice people there.
Mm. Well, people that could understand.
Well, no one judges you.
Mm.
Doesn't matter what you do.
Mm.
Just sing, dance, play the fool, do whatever you want in a crowd of 100 people, and no one will judge you.
Mm.
Can't do that in Adelaide.
Mm.
They'll all look at you sideways and go, he's mad.
Mm.
You know? So it was good to be able to express yourself without ridicule.
Mm. Yeah, and if it is that there's no harm being done to you or anyone else.
Mm. Well, that's the last thing on your mind. I think one of the misconceptions is they think that when you're on a high, you're either going to hurt yourself or someone else.
Mm.
And they think you're going to hurt yourself intentionally. And you're not. The last thing on your mind is hurting yourself. You want to live forever.
Mm.
You know, because it's such a wonderful experience. The last thing you're thinking of doing is bowing out.
Imagine if we could all get a tiny bit of that, what the world would be like.
It'd be a wonderful place.
Mm.
If you could switch it on and off. And look,
manage it.
People do switch it on and off with narcotics and you know, chemicals, illicit substances. They do. They tap in. They tap in and they get a download of DMT from their own pineal gland that sorts their own body out, their body and their mind out.
Mm.
But we call it illegal. You're not allowed to do that.
Mm.
You can't experiment with that.
Mm.
We'll take that off you and we'll fine you.
Mm.
If you do it again, we'll put you in jail.
There's lots of discussions and experimenting going on in America where they're talking about using psilocybin and MDMA for helping people like you.
Yeah, yeah.
But not in Australia?
Well, I met a woman. She was the first to be qualified as a psilocybin administering therapist, and she was in her 70s. She'd been doing counseling, trauma counseling all her life, and I was really lucky to find her. But she was accredited, but it was still illegal for her to do it. Mm. For her to administer it. So she didn't have a proper venue. She wanted to help me out, but she couldn't.
Mm.
But from a therapeutic perspective, she helped me out. You know, she picked me like a nose in 10 minutes, like no other therapist has ever. Mm. So, you know, she understands the chemical, the medicine behind it and what it can do. And hopefully more people will spring up like her and they'll be able to get accreditation and there'll be places that you can go and be looked after through a psychedelic journey with psilocybin mushrooms.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the power of the natural plant product.
Yeah.
As opposed to...
It's a natural plant. All you got to do is pick it and eat it.
Mm. As opposed to being, like you say, medically subdued.
Mm.
It is a difficult thing talking to someone who's in mania.
Yep, would be.
That's 'cause you can tell straight away that there's something amiss. You don't understand it. And yeah, the ideas are grandiose, which, you know, at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
You know, that's how things have been invented in the past, with grandiose ideas.
Benjamin Franklin and Nikola Tesla, they all had grandiose ideas and didn't sleep. Those guys didn't sleep.
Mm.
They'd be lucky if they got 2 or 3 hours a night.
Mm.
And look at what they achieved with no sleep.
Mm.
You know? But their minds just wouldn't shut them out. And they wouldn't allow themselves to be ridiculed, you know, and they'd fail at experiments dozens of times before they get a breakthrough.
Mm.
You know, most of us give up after the first time and the other half of us don't even try.
Mm.
So, hats off to those dudes.
Mm.
And, you know, if you've got wild ideas and you're building great towers in your backyard and you're not sleeping, in this day and age, they'll come and get you.
Mm.
They'll lock you up.
Mm.
We can't have him behaving like that.
Well, that's happened to you, hasn't it?
Yeah.
What's that like?
Getting locked up.
No, having people turn up in the middle of the night.
Yeah, it's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. It's the last thing you want. You're in the deepest, darkest of your sleep. And, they just turn up and start ringing your phone. Come with us. And it's all wrong. You know, no one's going to be at the hospital at 2 a.m. It's going to, you know, there's no doctors there to see you.
But they've turned up because of a phone call from a loved one that's worried.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a genuine thing.
Yeah.
That worry.
Yep.
Well, it's a welfare call. They call it a welfare check, don't they?
That's what they call it. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. You're on a community order now?
Yeah, I think that runs out soon.
Oh, does it? Okay, yeah, so it's not forever?
Don't think so.
Right, okay.
No, I think that one was for 6 months or something.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't... Because I wasn't doing anything wrong.
Mm.
You know, it'd be different if I was down Woolies chucking bricks through the windows or stealing cars or causing trouble.
But as you said, you know, when you're in that state, that you're not inclined to do that.
It's the last thing you're going to do.
Mm.
The last thing.
Mm.
You know.
I've thought about the community order if it was me, and I would feel like I was a prisoner.
Yeah, well, I mean, they just want me to stick to a medication regime for the course of that order.
So what can your family do to help in this scenario? Like, it seems to me like you're all kind of on your own trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
And no one else knows what to do or how to be.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot that they can do other than try and have some understanding. But as far as physically, I don't think there's anything they can do.
Mm. Do you understand why people would kind of ostracise you?
Yeah.
Mm. It's a fucked scenario, Mark.
Oh, well, what do you do?
Well, that's what I'm trying to get out of you.
Well, what you can always we do? Fucking jump off the roof, but then that's the end too soon. It's not time for the curtains to be called.
Mm. So you've thought about that?
Oh, yeah.
But not while you're in mania?
No.
Never?
Never. No. Mm. When you're in mania, you feel as though you're connected to the oneness of the universe,
mm.
and you want to live forever.
Mm.
Forever.
Mm.
Not just for the next 40 years and die when I'm 90. No mm. fucking way.
Mm.
So.
But when you're medicated to the eyeballs?
Well, when you're in a mental hospital, when they send you out, you're in a state of deep depression.
Okay. Yeah. You've ticked all the boxes, but you're in deep depression.
Yep. Yeah. Because we've depressed you now. Mm. You were high. We didn't like that.
Mm.
We want you low. So they get you as low as they can get you, and then they get you out the door.
Mm.
Yep. And oh, by the way, take this medication. It'll keep you low.
Yeah. Mm.
And you'll be stuck on your couch for most of the day, and you won't be getting up, doing things. You won't be lickety-split.
Far out.
Far out, yeah.
What do you see your future looking like?
I don't know. I'd like to get a job doing something.
Yeah.
Be nice to have a job not far from home. I've applied for quite a few, but, you know, 57. Got a fair few qualifications, but... You know, you don't even get a call back because people don't want a 57-year-old bloke shoveling horse shit in their stable.
Mm.
They want a 16-year-old kid. Mm. So I haven't had a response from any application I've made to a job. Not one.
Mm. And yeah, that's bizarre because at the moment it would appear that everyone's screaming for staff. Yeah,
that's what they say. So I'm just in that pigeonhole at the moment, mid-50s, qualified, but do we want him?
Mm.
Is he likely to do his back shoveling that horse shit?
Well, could you do aircraft engineering work?
Well, I've thought about that, and, you know, there are times when I get frustrated around the house trying to do shit with tools. And I think that maybe I wouldn't be able to curtail that frustration in the workplace.
Mm.
So I've kind of lost a bit of confidence in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the aircraft industry, anyway.
Mm.
But even so, putting a wheel on someone's car is just as important.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's interesting because a lot of people stay in their workplace too long.
Yep.
They can't recognise when it's time to give it away. And there's no shame in that. I recognizing it, I don't think.
Mm.
Well, you live in a magnificent spot on the planet.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. The driveway is a bit knackered at the moment, but hopefully we'll get that fixed soon. I just saw Nick coming in, so.
Well, like almost 260 degree view, looking down the Coorong.
Yeah.
I can think of worse places to be.
Yeah, for sure.
Hmm. But you're here by yourself.
Yep.
Are you lonely?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. What can we do about that?
I don't know. Ring me up every now and again. What else are we going to talk about?
Whatever you want. It's a not an enviable spot that you're in.
No, I reckon if I get a part-time job, it'll be good.
Yeah, just something to make you feel like you're part of a work community. I think people retire too early and they just get old, and you need that work contact, I think, the camaraderie.
Yeah, well, I still pull weeds with the group down here along the finish. We've got a 10K stretch.
Mm.
We get out every couple of weeks and done a lot of work. So, compared to what it was like when we bought it, it's a shame that it's not open to the public, really. I'd be happy for the front of my place to be open to the public and people walk through there. Mm. But no one even knows it's here. It's the second biggest river in South Australia.
Mm.
And we all know the Murray, the mighty Murray. Most of the people in Adelaide have never even heard of the Finnis, let alone been here.
Mm.
And just down there is it's a 15, 20 metre waterfall.
Mm.
On the second biggest river. And no one's seen it.
Mm.
They don't know where it is.
Mm.
So it's a...
You could put a sign up at the gate.
It's a hideaway.
Take people for tours in your zebra striped car.
Yeah, I've thought about that. Yeah.
People would pay.
People would pay. Well, Heisen crossed the Finnis only just upstream a bit. So surely when he crossed it, he walked up and down it a bit to have a look.
Mm.
You know, they could put it on the Heisen Trail.
Okay.
Hmm. Where he crossed and just go up and down a couple of miles and it'd be on there then.
Mm. But is there water in it year round?
No, it's stopped flowing at the moment.
Okay.
It's a few big pools. I've got one little paddle still.
That you can have a swim in?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Can you drink it?
I think all the runoff from farming and the glyphosate and that sort of shit, I think you want to steer clear of drinking it.
Mm.
But having said that, I do eat the yabbies that come out of it.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to say to your family?
Only that I'm sorry for fucking their days up. You know. I know it's not my fault, but it is my dilemma.
Mm.
You know, it's caused a lot of grief with Debbie. And not grief between the two of us, but grief for her. You know, she's been grieving for me. And it's taken its toll on her.
Mm.
Quite a bit.
Mm. Oh, it's a back to the not being able to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
The husband I married is not this guy.
Yeah.
What about the kids?
Yeah, I think I'm winning them back slowly. Yeah, hopefully. John and I are going pretty good at the moment.
Yeah. That's good.
Whereas he was pretty cross at me for a while there.
Mm.
Which I can understand, but, you know, it's not something that I do intentionally. It's not something I go, right, I'm going to go out and get high now and I'm going to start chanting all this bullshit and they're going to want to lock me up again. It's not an intentional thing.
Mm.
No one would want to intentionally go to the Margaret Tobin ward. You wouldn't.
Mm.
You know.
Sounds like the worst place on the planet.
Well, like I say, there's no help for you there.
Mm.
It's just a prison without bars. They use plexiglass windows instead, and you're locked in, and you can't get out, and you have to take their drugs.
Mm.
And you have to eat their food, or you go hungry. So, you know, that's all it is. It's not a therapeutic place. It's just incarceration to get you off the street until we can calm you down. And it seems that 3 weeks is the time frame.
Mm.
Pump all these drugs into you for 3 weeks, you should be right.
Mm.
Providing you behave, that is. A lot of people in there don't behave. You know, disrupting to the whole place. And you're trying to do the right thing. Sit quietly and mark your time. And you got some idiot throwing chairs and yelling and screaming at everyone.
Mm.
But there's nothing you can do.
Mm.
Got to give up these.
No good for you?
No good for the wallet. $50 a packet. You get a tiny bit in there.
Mm.
Who'd smoke? Grandma will be turning in her grave. She gave me $200, but I promised not to smoke.
Did she? Well, you probably don't need it, but it's probably something that helps you relax.
Yeah, it does.
Like, are you under stress?
Not now.
No.
But little things can become stressful, like, you know, even getting on the roof.
Mm.
You know, I realise that I'm not a young man anymore. I am 57.
Mm.
And you climb up on the roof on a windy day, and it was lucky because I left the ladder there and because I thought if I have to get up again, and I came inside and 5 minutes later it blew down. So I would have been stuck on the roof by myself, unable to get down because there's nowhere to climb down.
Mm.
No phone, phone's inside on the bench. What would I have done?
That's the problem with living up here by yourself.
So, you know,
pretty things, isolated.
Yeah, things like that. I got to plan ahead a bit, you know. And what am I going to do? Ring your neighbour, come and stand the ladder up for me.
Or you have to tie your ladder to your roof before you go up it.
Something.
Put a little hook up there so you can just.
Yeah, it needs something, a wire.
Mm. Is it hard to be motivated to do anything?
Yeah, well, the drugs are on me, got me on. Antipsychotic injection, a mood stabilizer. So if your mood is depressed, then we'll stabilize you there. And an anti-mania medication so that I don't go high.
Mm.
So yeah, I get a needle in the arm once a month and I take tablets every day.
And what's the, apart from your bowel stuff that you talked about, what's the some of the side effects?
Lethargy.
Mm.
Mainly. You wake up lethargic, you know.
Mm.
Whereas when I was living in Byron Bay, no way was I waking up lethargic. I was waking up with the first kookaburra and I was up and at him.
Mm.
So I'm a bit slower around here.
Mm.
And as a result of the medication, and they want me to take half what they've prescribed, and I take it at night and then go to bed, but they want me to then get up in the morning and take the same amount again in the daytime. And I've spoken to the doctors about that, and they've agreed that, you know, it's my life, so they're not displeased. They just recorded the fact that I'm on half of what they want me to be on.
Mm. Yeah, well, you probably wouldn't be able to be sitting having this conversation.
I'd probably be lying on the couch doing it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Can you sleep all right?
Yeah, I take a tablet for sleep and I time it. It's a wafer. It dissolves under your tongue. And it normally, you know, so I'll read and then when I'm ready for sleep, I'll take this tablet and I should be gone in 10 minutes. But there's a window, and if you don't go to sleep within about 30 or so, you can stay awake.
Oh, okay. Right.
And the party scene use it as a party drug. They take it, or they take a couple of them, and they fight through the drowsiness, and then they start drinking. And
right.
And it does something to them. I don't know what.
What's it called?
Olanzapine. Yeah. But I've never done that. I've never drunk on it.
Mm.
Yeah, you're supposed to be asleep, so you take another depressant, an alcohol, and I can't imagine what it would do to you.
Mm.
I can't imagine.
Mm. How do you feel about this conversation? Happy?
Yeah. Well, it's going pretty slowly, but you might have some editing to do.
That's all right. Well, it was good to tell your story.
Well, I haven't said much. You must have some more questions.
Well, I'm interested in the Byron Bay side of things.
Yep.
Obviously, that was your happy place. I mean, you even started making didgeridoos.
I did. Learned how to walk in the bush and find them. Had to cut a tree down, which I already sort of knew how to, and then chisel it out and carve down the outside of it. And that was all a good bit of fun. I probably made, with the ones I got here, I probably made 8 or 10. Sold a couple, gave a couple away.
So you're looking for a log that's already hollow?
Yeah, one that the ants have chewed out.
So there's nothing, no work to be done on the inside?
Oh, it depends, yeah. Often there's quite a bit.
Yep.
Big long chisel, 3 foot, 4 foot long.
Okay, yeah.
Yep.
Just to get like the dags out?
Yeah, some of it's pretty hard work. Like, yeah, it can sometimes take you a couple of days to get the guts out of it. But I've got one over there that I didn't touch, that the ants did it all.
Mm.
And all I did was seal it up. So that plays pretty good.
Can you play it?
I can make a noise out of it, but I can't play it.
The circular breathing's the thing.
No, I haven't figured that out yet.
I bet you once you figure it out, you'll go, oh, that's easy.
Yeah, probably. One of the guys that I made a didgeridoo for, I was teaching him how to play it, because I know the theory. And he plays guitar. And he came in one day and he said, now, I know what needs to be done. I just have to do it. I've got all the pieces of this puzzle. I just have to put it together. And he sat down, and in 5 minutes, he was doing the circular breathing.
Right, okay.
Yeah, just like that.
So how do you do it?
you've got to fill your cheeks like a trumpet player would, and then use that air in your cheeks to keep the rumble in the didgeridoo going while you inhale through your nose.
Right, okay. Yeah, that sounds pretty simple.
So you've got to blow out of your mouth as you suck in your nose.
So the blowout's a muscular action?
Something like that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So if you can do that, you're away.
Mm.
But you don't have to learn how to do that first. I mean, you can just honk away on it and blow it and make a noise out of it.
Mm.
Yeah. But even, I went and saw one guy who makes them for a living, and some of his didges he sells for over $2,000.
Really?
And he makes them for guys like Xavier Rudd and those sorts of people. And he said when he plays, sometimes takes him half an hour or more for his lips to lubre up enough to be able to play it properly.
To get it going.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So if you don't play it and you have a honk on it once a week as you walk past, you like I do, it's probably going to take a while.
But you, apart from your lethargy, you've got plenty of time. That could be your mission.
It could. It was good in Byron because we'd all do it, and we'd take 3 or 4 didgeridoos and we'd just pass them around in the circle and we'd all have a play.
Mm.
And someone was always playing guitar. And so there was always music. And so it was easy to play. Plus, you didn't feel like a git out there with your didgeridoo because you're not the only one.
Mm.
You know, and if you do make it sound shit house, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. What about locally from
like an exercise point of view.
Yeah, apart from a bit of walking around the block, I don't do much. Yeah.
Once again, you probably don't feel like it.
I don't feel like it. When I was in Byron, I was doing yoga at least once a day, if not twice, and feeling really fit because of it. And I haven't done it since I've been home. So I need to get a video or something of yoga and start doing that again, because that will help.
What about things like learning to surf and stuff like that? Does that interest you?
Yeah, but, you know, again, it's kind of like a team sport. You're better off you go down with a couple of mates. And I was doing a bit of surfing in Byron Bay with friends, but I don't know about going down there by myself.
Are you tempted to go back up there?
Not at the moment. One day I might. Yeah, if they get their arts factory cinema and all that side of the house going again the way they want to, then there'd be employment there.
With regards your family and what they can do, if it is that we're on the phone to you and we recognise that you're elevated into mania, what's your advice to us?
Don't panic. You know,
what can we say to, like,
well, you could talk about that fact. You could try and eke some information out of me. Like, if I was in mania now, I definitely want you to be recording it. Definitely. Regardless of how crazy what I say sounds like, record it, for goodness sake, because I want to know what I'm talking about. Everyone's saying you're off your head, Mark, you're talking pie in the sky shit. Well, that's all well and good, but I'd love to hear it. I'd love to have it played back so that I could try and understand where these thoughts come from, and whether there is any merit in any of these ideas, or if they're all just scatterbrain, because they could be.
Well, when you're in that mode, it's very difficult to get a word in, because you're quite excited about the news that you've got to tell us.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like, I can't even say anything here.
Yeah. Well, you could just be up front and say, are you manic again? What have you been doing?
Okay. And and how will that affect you? Is that going to shock you into, like, oh, shit, am I?
Could do. Could do.
Because you won't know you are. You don't recognise the difference between here today and elevated next week.
Yeah, but again, I probably... Look, the last thing you want is someone raining on your parade. And the way in which they do it is just not fun. It's not fun at all. And even the guy at Tweed Heads, like, I was absolutely behaving myself, sitting quietly on the stretcher. But in order to get a needle in me, all I had to do was ask me and I would offer my arm. But he pulled me off the stretcher in the headlock and had me head ground into the floor while they jabbed me in the guts.
Really?
Yeah. And there's no need for that. No need at all. There was no fight in me. And yet he had to bring the fight. And those guys, those security guards that work at those hospitals, they're all the same. And they all like their job way too much. Way too much. You know, if they can't get a guy in a headlock today, they haven't had a good day. So you know what's coming. You know what's coming. And it's not pleasant. It's not polite. You got no say in the matter. They've got you. You're coming with us. You know, involuntarily. Involuntary patient. That's what you are. There's no escape.
No, my body, my choice.
No, definitely not. No, my mind, my choice.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, so yeah, they just get you. Get you, grab you, drug you.
I wish there was an answer. I wish that I could understand it better, and I've read a lot of stuff trying to. I wish I could understand it better to be able to help you. And seeing you in the depressed mode is equally as difficult as seeing you in the elevated mode. There's no... The happy medium only lasts for a short period of time.
Yeah.
But as I said at the beginning, I could understand a busted leg or if you said I've got cancer. But I can't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's difficult.
But I like your idea of ring me up.
Yeah.
Have a chat. And maybe we can all do that a little bit better.
Yep.
Oh, should we finish up and have some pumpkin soup?
If you want.
Yeah? Are you hungry?
Not really.
No?
No.
Oh, we don't have to.
It's up to you.
Yeah, you see people like living on the streets. In bigger cities, it's more so like Melbourne. And I look at them and I think, how did you get here?
Mm.
But you could probably understand how they could get there.
Easily, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I was living like that in Byron Bay.
Not really on the street, but...
Not really on the street, but, you know, we'd certainly eat out of the dumpsters. The bakery was one of the best.
Mm.
And they'd put all their stuff in bags for us.
Mm.
Fresh as a daisy, Danishes. And
it's called a freegan.
A freegan.
Mm.
Living like a freegan.
Mm.
Yeah, well, someone would bring a bag in every day of fresh baked goods.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing what's thrown out. Good food thrown out. But yeah, to see those people on the streets and, you want to say, just why don't you just go home, but they probably don't have one.
Well, there was one guy who lived on the streets. He'd been in Byron Bay for 10 years from France, and he's an illegal immigrant because he hasn't gone home yet, and he lives on $10 a day.
How does he get $10?
He makes jewellery.
Okay.
Yeah, I bought a couple of them.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he just lives on the footpath?
He's got a tent in the bush.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
So they haven't found him and moved him on.
Mm.
Yeah, a lot of people like that. They've just got little tents in the bush.
Mm. And these people have gotten to rock bottom. They might have been doctors or helicopter pilots or whatever. And would you say in most cases it's probably mental illness?
Would have something to do with it.
Mm.
Yep.
Mm.
Yep. That their families walked away from them.
Mm.
Or their mental illness has led to their financial downfall.
Mm. Yeah, well, you do hear about those sorts of things. People go into mania and they go and spend all their money.
Yep.
And then it's gone.
Yep.
Yeah. You haven't had that problem yet?
No, well, Debbie was worried that I was going to do that.
Mm.
But I'm not.
Mm.
Just looking for investment opportunities, as most people do.
Mm. Yeah, well, the one you're sitting on is a pretty good one.
Yeah, hopefully it'll, you know, when the time comes, make a few dollars.
Mm.
But again, you got to go somewhere.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You don't want to trade this for something that's not as good.
No.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you for...
No worries. Didn't say much.
Letting us know what the situation is so that hopefully other people listening can maybe get something out of it that might help them or might help other family members, because there's just no way of knowing as a family member.
No.
Or understanding.
Even when they discharge you, you know, they give you a discharge report, and most of it's about why you were brought in, what you did while you were in there, you know, did he behave, did he misbehave? Some of the things they write down are so trivial. And, but no, other than take this tablet twice a day, no future guidance.
Mm.
You know, might sling you a couple of pamphlets.
Mm.
That's about it.
Like in the ideal world, what would you hope to see as you're released from something like that?
Well, there's so many people with different problems in there. No one, I mean, the last time I was admitted here in South Australia, they wrote on the report, this is 5 minutes after I got there, clearly this man has a mental health condition. Okay. Which one?
Mm.
What have I got?
Mm.
Clearly I've got one. What is it?
Mm.
If it's clear to you.
But it could have been that you were admitted because you'd lost your mind because your child had died.
Yeah.
And now you've been labelled with a mental health condition.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's not... The mental health system is a disaster.
Mm.
Yeah, from what I've seen in at least two states.
Mm.
And I'd imagine it's probably similar in other states. Imagine they have these... like a Centrelink store, you go to them, they're all the same.
Mm.
You know, the way, even the layout of the facility was basically the same.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think they're there to help you in the long term. I think they're there to get you off the street in the short term and suppress any abnormal activity that's going on in your brain.
Or suppress any emotion.
And then let you out.
Mm.
But there certainly is, emotions are high in those places. There's all sorts of people with all sorts of dilemmas. Some people are quiet and say nothing the whole time. Other people, they'll just yell and scream all day, every day, get me out of here.
Is it frightening being in there?
Oh, sometimes it can be. If there's an angry man going berserk, yeah. That can be frightening because you're stuck in there with him.
Mm.
Can't get out.
Mm.
They're all behind their glass wall, but you're not. You're out there with him.
Mm.
So, yeah, it can be.
Mm.
For sure.
Yeah.
Big bloke throwing chairs, saying he's going to kill someone.
Yeah.
But again, they normally bring the guards in and give you another needle if you do that.
Far out.
Mm.
Well, I hope to never go in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would reckon that most people listening would say the same thing.
Yeah, well, as I say, they're not. It's not a place of help.
Mm.
It's not even a refuge, you know. It's just a... So it's more like a concentration camp.
A misery.
It's not a cheerful place.
Mm.
No.
How is it that you're affected by schizophrenia? What are your symptoms?
I don't know how many that I know of. I mean, I've read up about it, and I don't have what they call schizophrenia. I thought schizophrenia was where you had multiple personalities, and I don't have that.
Mm.
Or you hear voices, and I don't have that. So
how do they diagnose you with that then?
The
trifecta.
Stuck that label on me way back, possibly an underlying schizoaffective disorder. That was after my first incarceration.
Mm, okay.
So whatever they see in your behaviour
at the time
meets the DSMV, because that's where they get their knowledge from. Just one book, and it's not a very big book.
What's the DSMV?
The Diagnostics and Statistics Manual. Edition 5 for mental health.
Okay.
And all you got to do is go through there and see, well, has this chum got these symptoms? Yes, he has. Well, that equals this diagnosis. It's pretty easy. Anyone could diagnose you out of the DSMV.
And once you've received that diagnosis, do you have it forever?
I think so, yeah.
Mm.
That's interesting. I don't know how you can unglue yourself.
Yeah. Do you remember what you are saying to people when you are in mania, like in a phone call or anything like that?
No, only until they remind me.
Okay.
Only when they remind me, I go, oh, fuck yeah, I did say that. You know? But, so no.
But it's not something that you're able to recall at the time.
Well, some of it is, but, you know, some of it's not.
Mm. I wonder how that works.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. So you're happy for us to, you know, if it is that this occurs again, for to remind you, and like you said, to even record it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Because if I don't realise it, but you do, you know, that's got to be a good thing.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, a helpful thing, hopefully.
Yeah.
I get that you want to give up your medication as soon as possible.
No, Dan, I'm going to stay on it this time.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Well, I could be fucked going back to hospital. Fuck that action.
Well, that was my question, is that if you do, you're just going to repeat everything over again.
Yeah, no. I've been there, done that. Got the T-shirts, other people's T-shirts.
Yeah. Is it possible that you could find a happy medium where you can be in an equilibrium where you're not depressed but you're not in mania with a minimal dose?
Yeah, hopefully.
Have you tried that at all ever? Or?
Yeah, well, it may be that I have to ask the doc about reintroducing an antidepressant.
Okay.
You know, just something mild in the mix. I never did really like taking them.
No.
Because when you're deeply depressed, they don't seem to help you.
Mm.
But, yeah, it could be that that's all I need.
Mm. Yeah, well,
if I have to stick on the chem trail.
I get that the mania is the place to be, but it's not a sustainable place to be from a point of view of trying to hold down a job or maintain relationships with family or friends.
Yeah. No, you couldn't.
Mm. I reckon people will be pretty happy to hear that that's your plan. And that's the best place to be, isn't it? Have a plan, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Awesome.
Want some soup then?
Might as well. Good chat.
Good chat. Thanks.
Stand up and walk out on me. Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do you feel? All I need is my brother. I say I'm gonna get high. Tell don't insane no more. Certain it happens all the time, yeah.
What do you see when you turn out the light?
I can't tell you, but it sure feels
la mala. Don't you know I'm on?